If Washington wants to get right with voters, it has to start listening to them.
Welcome to Beyond the Bubble. I'm Kristen Roberts, Washington editor for the 30 news organizations all around America that together make McClatchy. Every week, we call the reporters and political operatives who live and work in battleground states and ask them to tell us how voters are reacting to Donald Trump and Republican Washington, and what issues Americans outside the Beltway are thinking about that D.C. still is not. Always at my side, Alex Rorty, national political correspondent. Alex, thank you for being here. Today's show is a little bit different.
We know we're going to bring in a couple of old colleagues, Josh Krossauer and Tim Alberta, and we're going to talk about the Democratic presidential field. It's never too early.
It's never too early. You ready?
Let's do it.
January 20th, the day the people became the rulers of this nation again.
Our ideals and fundamental values are being attacked. Do we retreat or do we fight? I say we fight.
He heard those voices that were out there that other people weren't hearing, and he just earned a mandate.
It is time for Democrats to grow a backbone and get out there and fight.
The American people would like to try something new. We would like to see the country go in a different direction to change the course for America.
He doesn't take this presidency seriously enough.
So to all Americans, hear these words. You will never be ignored again.
All right, Alex, let's say hello to our very smart panel. Let's start with Tim Alberta, political correspondent at Politico Magazine. Welcome.
It is so great to be here. I'm honored.
It is really great to see your face.
If I had a nickel for every dime.
And to Josh Krossauer, who is a columnist, political editor at National Journal. Welcome back.
I'm glad to be here, and this is a great reunion.
I can't believe who we have around this table with us, because we have argued about this very issue for a couple cycles now, and we've had pretty intense arguments, especially leading into 2016. But here we are looking at, suddenly, 2020 Democratic candidates. And Josh, you guys came out with your first power rankings. Why don't you tell our listeners what the hotline power rankings are?
So we try to look into our crystal balls, and it's a collaborative effort, rather, with the three of the hotline colleagues over at National Journal, Adam Wallner, Kyle Trickstad, who's editor-in-chief of the Hotline, and Hannah Trudeau, who covers the emerging 2020 presidential field. And we basically tried to combine our best reporting, our best analysis, and look at this really wide-open Democratic field. And we tried to assess not what's happening now, but we tried to predict or analyze who in a couple years are going to be the most compelling, most electable, most charismatic candidates that could emerge in the 2020 Democratic field. And it's a long list.
So the theory behind power rankings has always been a little bit debatable for me, a little dodgy, frankly, right? I mean, when we did power rankings for 2016, it was a question of who we saw really winning 2 years from now, or you know, 16 months or 12 months from now, versus who was up in this moment, right? So when you approached it this year, you were really looking at who had the most upside potential and would still be at the top when we approached 2020?
That's right, Kristen. We kind of looked at the political environment 2 years from now. We tried to be like the college football scouts who are looking at the top talent and trying to assess how they're going to make it in a political environment that's going to be very brutal and very competitive in a couple years. And this is a lot of predictions. There's a lot of guesswork involved. It's not – the crystal ball can be very foggy, as we learned 4 years ago. But I think it's as important as ever, given just how wide open the prospective 2020 Democratic field is, to kind of narrow it down and say who really has the tangible assets, who really has the fundamental qualities that would make for a compelling presidential candidate. And we kind of looked from the field of elective politics. We looked at a lot of senators, and we actually debated, and we didn't ultimately put any outsiders on the list.
So before we get to the attack mode, why don't you give us one, two, three, just the top three?
The top three on the list, and I would actually say the top four, because I think this was the consensus first tier. Kamala Harris, California senator, has the checklist of qualities that would make a strong Democratic nominee. Excites the base, multiracial candidate that checks sort of the identity politics boxes, is liberal on a lot of the big issues that Democratic voters care about. She kind of has the upside, more upside than any of the other candidates we talked about. The veterans, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, both of them are high on the list.
The old men.
Bernie is going to be almost 80. But these are people who are already making moves or already saying things, writing books to run. So we weighed that pretty heavily in their favor. The wild card, and I think with the news in the past week that Sherrod Brown may not be facing his most formidable Senate opponent, Sherrod Brown is a guy on paper, a senator who checks all the boxes of electability, exciting the progressive base, a blue-collar guy, can win over some Trump voters in his home state. No one's really talking a lot about him because he has to win his Senate race first. We think that he's someone who, if he has any interest in running for president, he's going to be high on the list of people who have high possibilities.
The John Kasich of the Democratic Party.
He is from Ohio, and that is a good state to be from.
That was an electoral insult there, that he's the John Kasich.
I wasn't sure where you were coming from.
It's not an insult. It's not an insult. It speaks to his qualifications on paper, right? John Kasich was a fantastic candidate on paper and not a great candidate in reality.
And had some crossover appeal.
And Sherrod Brown would have that, particularly with a sort of white working class voters, which if the sort of Sherrod Brown for president train gets going, he would have won Ohio. He would have some talent or appeal to these voters who went for Trump 4 years ago. And that would sort of be the genesis of the case. But he's almost impossible for me to gauge right now because I can't tell if he is at all interested in running for president. He doesn't seem like, until recently, the kind of senator who people would even put on a long list of.
So Ben Terris, our friend, former National Journal colleague, wrote a great piece in 2016 at The Washington Post arguing that Sherrod Brown is a perfect presidential candidate, but he doesn't want to run. We know from some subsequent reporting that Hillary had him on her short list. She didn't want to lose a Senate seat, but she was considering very, very strongly. And we also know that he's not talking about this because he can't get caught dead talking about a presidential campaign when he still has to win over the voters of Ohio for another term. So I think there's some X factors that even though he's not openly saying, I want to run for president, he may be doing so in a year.
But you have an awful lot of United States senators who are reelected every 6 years by substantial margins in their home states, are very popular in their home states, raise a decent amount of money in their home states. They are tight with the party activists and the fringe base of the party in their states, and they can excite them and they can give a speech and rah-rah. But when they get on the national stage, we've seen this for generations, these people cannot elevate their game. They cannot get to the next level. Sherrod Brown, to me, would seem to be sort of a quintessential case of that. You take Sherrod Brown outside of Ohio, and how does he do? Especially given the fact that, I don't know if you saw this tweet from the Democratic Party yesterday about electing women, and it sort of checked off all of these identity politics groups, as Josh referred to it a minute ago. Elect Muslim women, elect LGBT women. The point is the Democratic Party is obviously looking for diversity, I think almost first and foremost.
White men wasn't one of those boxes.
White men from the Rust Belt, I don't quite know if that's going to activate and galvanize and mobilize the national party base in the way that it might in Ohio, specific to the Ohio party base, that, you know, a group of individuals that really know Sherrod Brown.
The white male thing, and not just the white male, but the old white woman thing is what bothers me about your list, but it bothers me about most of the lists that we've seen so far for 2020. I mean, just for the listeners, to round out your list, you did the top four. Bottom six are Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Eric Garcetti, Chris Murphy, and Seth Moulton. Now, look, we'll talk, yes. Okay, Chris Murphy and Seth Moulton, I don't even understand why you did that, not even a little bit. There are only three women on this list. There are three people of color on this list. There are three octogenarians on this list. Most of the list is filled with old white men.
Well, let me since you raised some challenges to some of the names on the list. First off, I think both Moulton and Murphy were 9 and 10. So this is the bottom tier of the list.
So was Donald Trump once.
But I do say, I know, Trump was
Murphy's in the pole position, baby. Yeah.
But the question is, why would Moulton be on the list, for example, over Amy Klobuchar who didn't make the list, or, you know, other governors, other people of color or women that have been mentioned.
Or people
in the
outside
field
of politics, though, Josh.
Well, the question about people outside of politics, and this was a debate we had internally, is that you just don't know. I mean, do you want to bet on Oprah running? Do you want to bet on Mark Cuban running? Do you want to? That was ultimately the decision we had to make, and it's hard to kind of bet on one of those folks running when odds are against them. you're going to have a field of pretty like-minded Democrats where the play to be more diverse, the play to be more liberal is going to be very apparent. Seth Moulton is going in a different direction. So just like we saw the Republican field being so crowded and having, you know, nearly a dozen candidates kind of saying the exact same things, you have a Seth Moulton who went to Iowa, who is an Iraq War veteran, who worked for David Petraeus, who has a tailor-made biography for you know, and in any party. And he's not saying the same things that a lot of the Democratic frontrunners or a lot of the leaders in the party are. And in Iowa, the electorate is a lot, as we all know, is a lot wider and frankly a lot more moderate than the rest of the country. And New Hampshire is the same dynamic. So if you believe that the early states still have a big outsized role to play, that they still vet these candidates, they still kind of are a force into giving momentum to some underdogs, I think someone like a Seth Moulton is tailor-made for that environment. I think it's a long-shot play. I think, you know, odds are he's probably not going to be a front-runner for the nomination. But if you're looking for a sleeper and someone who kind of isn't saying the exact same thing that a lot of other Democratic candidates are, I think he's a worthwhile guy to watch.
That was an unexpectedly strong case for Seth Moulton. I'm a little caught off guard, actually.
Against the grain, if you will.
Against the grain. Well, the idea of having a veteran run against Trump, too, was exceptional. It's actually one of the reasons who I think is probably ranks as even more of a long shot than Seth Moulton, but was on my list as a dark horse, Jason Kander, who lost the Senate race but has stayed active in politics. He's formed this voting rights group. But more than that, and I think it's going to be so important for the Democratic field, you watch Jason Kander and you read his tweets, actually. And I know it's Twitter, but that is the medium of our time in politics. And he has this anti-Trump voice down, just pitched perfect. The snappiness of his tweets, what they're directed at, you know, and you see he gets this huge response every time he tweets. You know, and this is a failed candidate for Senate in Missouri in 2016, you know, who has nonetheless become something of a celebrity within the Democratic Party because he was able to overperform Hillary Clinton's ticket. He's giving these big speeches to the DNC. You know, he is someone, look, this is a long shot, and I think in previous presidential power rankings, we wouldn't even bother to discuss him. But he is someone who merits mention, just like someone like Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana. There is a huge vacancy for governors right now. You figure at least somebody has to rise to the top. As much as he's not really known or even discussed in D.C. circles, he did come to town this spring and gave a speech before the Center for American Progress, was one of the few that day that actually stood out, that people actually noticed and can remember afterward. He maybe has a little spark.
I'm sorry. You guys are coming up with all the names that nobody knows.
We're talking dark
like
horses
here. The name
here.
ID on these candidates you guys are coming up with is so flippin'
low.
We are
in a uncharted new era
yes.
here. This list is a wonderful place to start. It's a great discussion spark for us looking forward to 2020 as we turn the calendar now into 2018 and people begin to prepare their campaigns to launch about a year from now, a little over a year from now, maybe in the spring of 2019. But I think that what we have in the era of Trump is an entirely new chapter in American political history where people are going to be looking to the outside for excitement, for fresh ideas, for fresh faces. I just think this idea that the Democratic base is going to be content to choose between a couple of congressmen, a couple of senators, maybe a governor, I think it's crazy. I mean, I think you are going to absolutely have disruptive forces, whether that be a Mark Cuban, whether it be an Oprah Winfrey, whether it be a couple of major CEOs, whether it be a couple of deep-pocketed billionaire philanthropists on the left who can pour their own money in and who can start all kinds of affiliated outside groups to help them along the way. I think that the 2020 Democratic field is going to be even more asymmetrical and unpredictable than the 2016 Republican field was.
So I agree entirely with that. And I think the big question is who of this vast array of celebrities or philanthropists or businessmen or businesswomen are going to jump in the field? The reason I might disagree with the big picture is that this is a sort of an axiom of David Axelrod's. The guy or gal who's running for president after the predecessor is the opposite of that personality, of that political background. And Donald Trump's got a lot of detractors, clearly. But one of the big criticisms coming from the Democratic Party is he had no experience. He's not ready to run the government. And the question that Oprah or any other outsider is going to have to deal with, and they may be able to overcome that, but it's a big question that Democrats are going to have to answer internally, is whether they can kind of ignore that criticism of Trump that they've been making for quite a long time and say, we need one of our own outsiders who has absolutely no government experience to be the standard bearer in a few years.
See, I actually thought the bigger criticism of Trump and the question for Democrats was, is he capable of doing the job? Is he suited to the office? I don't think it had as much to do with his preparedness or his qualifications. I think if you saw a Democratic candidate who had similar business background, similar personal wealth, life accomplishments to Trump, I don't know that you would see those same questions raised. Again, it just seems to me as though, even with Axelrod's advice notwithstanding, that is the conventional wisdom that applied in the pre-Twitter, pre-social media, pre-Donald Trump political world. And it feels to me like we are through the looking glass now and that we're never going back.
So who are the people then who would fit that description who you could see running? And does it even include people who we haven't even thought of?
It's Zuckerberg. It's Cuban. It's Sandberg. Maybe it's Winfrey. It's people who have not been in politics before but have had life experience and business experience, who have shown an ability to organize a huge organization and marshal resources to an end and to a purpose.
For sure. And two other things I would add to that critically. First, universal name ID. Think about the two things that propped up Trump throughout the entire 2016 campaign, and they're related. Number one was 100% name ID, and number two was the ability to command media attention at the drop of a hat because of that universal name ID. Donald Trump could phone into a Sunday show the way that nobody else could. So if Oprah Winfrey, for example, if she runs, right, I feel like any speech she gives, any interview she wants, anything she wants to do to command the media attention in that given cycle and to sort of deprive the rest of the field of oxygen, she can do. I think she will have that unique ability in a way that no congressman or senator would.
The celebrity factor is huge. The name ID factor is huge. She also checks a lot of boxes demographically that the Democrats need to deal with. I think Kristen made a great point that, like, the three women on our list, three people of color, and the party is going in a different direction. And they haven't had many candidates that fit either category in past elections. But what Oprah does is, you know, she would excite the base. It's really hard for Democrats to find sort of someone who's progressive and also can win over, like, African-American women and get those two parts of the Democratic Party base together. Obama did that masterfully in 2008. And, you know, Michelle Obama's name was mentioned in the aftermath of the 2016 election. Oprah Winfrey is sort of checking a lot of those same boxes demographically.
Well, it's inconceivable to me that the Democrats can beat Donald Trump by nominating anyone who is white. I mean, this is a party that is supposed to be the party representing the interests of people of color in America, of disadvantaged communities in America. And if they put forward another octogenarian white person, they are going to lose.
Let me just say, I mean, one of the things to watch with these celebrity candidates is a phenomenon we saw happen with Trump repeats itself, and that the celebrity and the force of personality is able to overcome these problems with their ideology or their agenda. You know, because this is a progressive party. This is a party that regards basically rich people warily and thinks that the country's own policies have been skewed too much toward them. And those are the kind of questions that are going to confront Oprah Winfrey. You know, does Oprah Winfrey want Medicare for all? Does she understand the sort of plight of the working person? I mean, that has been her show, and that's one of the reasons she's been so popular. But she's literally a billionaire.
That is such a great point.
It is a really good point.
I mean, because if you think about the Republican Party and its litmus test, to the extent that they ever existed and to the extent that they existed in 2016, they basically all went out the window because Donald Trump was able to shape the party in his image. The only exception, and I think it's probably the exception that will remain in the Republican Party for the foreseeable future, is abortion. And Donald Trump very smartly got ahead of the abortion question, said that he had this, you know, transformation, a totally new line of thinking after once saying that he was proudly pro-choice and supported partial birth abortion. Donald Trump, at the time he ran for president, said that he was completely anti-abortion. But everything else, trade, immigration, free markets, it doesn't really matter. Infrastructure, debt and deficit spending. Trump was able to get away with basically anything. I don't know if the same will be true on the Democratic side. It seems as though you do have now these emerging and really, I feel like, set in stone litmus tests on the Democratic side on issues of marriage, on issues of a woman's right to choose, on issues of universal health care. I think you can go down the list, but really I think we've seen some differences in the two parties in that sense, in terms of the sort of ideological rigidity of the two parties. Can somebody like Oprah or anybody else for that matter find a way to thread the needle?
I think we're in the age, and I agree with both of you, this is the cult of celebrity. And I think the big question is the celebrity going to come from within politics? I mean, our top three candidates on the list are all essentially celebrities within politics, Biden, Sanders, and Kamala Harris, who maybe isn't quite at that level, but she's sort of hyped.
She's among political journalists.
Political journalists, absolutely, right? Or is the celebrity going to come from outside? And I think the risk of someone from the outside is, you know, in Hollywood, everyone has their image handlers. You know, Oprah has an unbelievably strong image, if you believe the limited polling we've seen about her. What happens when we saw last night among, I think, some Republicans on Twitter were circulating a photo of her palling with Harvey Weinstein?
That's the thing about celebrities. When political journalists sink their teeth in and start tearing flesh, they have no idea what kind of scrutiny comes with running for office.
And explain why that would be applied to Oprah and not Donald Trump.
So the biggest difference with Oprah is that she casts herself as this goddess who is above it all. You know, Donald Trump never did. Donald Trump is, look, I grab vote for me. You know, Oprah Winfrey stands back and says, I am an amazing human being who does great things for humanity. How dare you question me?
Does the FCC regulate podcasts?
No.
I'm sorry, the President of the United States said I'm not allowed to say it.
I think we're
most
bleeping
certainly
that.
Are.
Christian's absolutely right. And it's amazing in the world of politics what we've learned with the Me Too movement. The difference between public and private, what we see publicly and what we hear about privately is huge. And it's an issue that celebrities, I think, have to deal with or will have to deal with even more so because they have these image handlers, they have this perception that people look terrific, and then you realize that there's a lot of baggage, there are a lot of skeletons in a lot of people's closets.
Can I make a serious point about Oprah? Because I saw a lot of chatter on Twitter last night about, so what are the potential vulnerabilities, right? Like, complete this sentence. Oprah's fatal deficiency with the base of the Democratic Party is blank, right? And I don't know how we answer that question, but I can just say from a kind of broader 30,000-foot political perspective, if you're looking at a potential Oprah Winfrey candidacy, the one thing that would make her vulnerable for me, whether it's from the left or from the right, are questions of the willingness to use deadly military force on a large scale. And I'm serious about that because I think there would be questions about the image of Oprah globally as someone who builds schools and builds hospitals. Like, would she be willing to use drones to blow up schools and hospitals if there were insurgents inside? I think that would be one area where both Democrats and Republicans would seek to paint her as somebody who is not up to the job, not somebody who's willing to use the kind of military force or make the threat of military force in a way that a president would have to.
That's interesting.
As literally zero foreign policy experience.
That's very interesting.
In any way. Just to the point to bring this back to the top of the list, the person I have there is Joe Biden. And I think it's and Kristen's going to hate this, but all the reasons that we just talked about with Oprah, that she hasn't been vetted, we don't know, you know, how would she handle a national stage when people are confronting her. We know those answers with Joe Biden. He has been vetted. He is a plausible candidate. I think we actually underestimate his popularity with the sort of rank and file Democrats, and has 100% name ID. I mean, this is like I'm remembering when we put these lists together for the Republican field in 2016, when in a heartbeat I would take the field over Joe Biden in this. But if you're asking who I think is number one, I think it's Biden. And just watching his body language, I have no inside information. I'm not going to pretend that I do. But he is someone who so clearly wants to run for president.
How is Kamala Harris on the top of everybody's list and we're not talking about her?
What is Kamala Harris's national name ID? Do we know?
I know that it's going to be pretty low. She's a freshman senator, and she doesn't get the media attention that Sanders and Biden do. I would assume it's like 10 to 20%.
This feels like when we – remember in 2012, Josh, when we put the list together and John Thune was at the top of the list? And nobody outside of the Beltway and South Dakota had ever heard of John Thune, right? Like, I just
– she's the Marco Rubio of the Democratic field. Yeah. That was who I was very bullish on in 2016. And he did live up to some of that potential, but ultimately – you know, it was easy for me to overrate him because of the factors we're talking about. But I do think she's got the biggest upside, but she's also got the biggest fizzle factor. So I could easily see her totally not even running or not even making an impact. But I do think she has a lot of upside that would be silly to ignore.
So to piggyback on Alex's point a minute ago, I should note that for all the talk of the Democratic Party wanting to pursue diversity and Kristen's well-taken point about white male octogenarians not exciting the party base,
Elizabeth Warren.
And female. I would be loath to not agree with Rorty to the extent that, look, in 2020, right? This demographic transformation that is sweeping the country is not finished yet. It's really not even all that far along yet. So in 12, 16, 20 years and well beyond, then we will be having a conversation in which the Democratic Party can very likely win national elections by just going farther to the left. I do not think that is the case in 2020. I actually think that the best chance the Democratic Party has to retake the White House is by nominating something of a centrist Democrat, because ultimately, if it is somebody who can both excite the party base and win back the broad swaths of independent-minded Obama-Trump voters in middle America, that person will have a much easier path to the White House than somebody who continues and sort of ratchets up the polarization that we've seen over the last several cycles. So Joe Biden, having the ability to both excite the Democratic base, as he has shown an ability to do, and also to appeal to the blue-collar, white, middle, and working-class voters in the Rust Belt in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, I think Joe Biden is actually the Democratic Party's best bet to win back the White House, even though I know that that is not what a lot of liberal activists in the party want to hear.
I don't know. Don't we have enough evidence at this point that 2020 is going to be an identity election?
This is the case for celebrity. This is the case for Oprah. She is so famous. Her speech at the Golden Globes last night was so reassuring. It was designed for purple America. It wasn't designed for red or blue America. That she doesn't have to cast positions to the left of a lot of the elected officials that are going to be running. Her celebrity and just her personality is strong enough that, just like Trump, but Trump didn't have to, you were saying this earlier, Tim, but he didn't have to take the conservative position on every issue because he was so famous and his tone and his zeitgeist with the Republican electorate was so strong. I think that if Oprah runs and she puts together a good operation, that's her biggest advantage. She could be a unified moderate like Obama was in 2008, and you would get support from both wings of the party, and you wouldn't have a whole lot of things to criticize her on, even if she took a more moderate position on some of these hot button issues.
You know, there are parts, if Biden were the nominee, you know, that he is an older white man, that a lot of his agenda is not aligned with the Democratic Party's current priorities. There could be problems. I think the question is, and what you would hope for if you're a Biden supporter, is just the disgust and hate is not too strong a word for Donald Trump, is so strong that it overcomes everything else, and that every Democratic voter will put that aside and say, this is beyond sort of particulars of policy. This is a battle for the soul of the nation. And in that frame, that's where I could see Biden, you know, emerging as someone people think should take on Trump, because, again, he's plausible. The biggest problem with Kamala Harris right now, and I agree she has the highest upside, we have no idea if she's going to be able to handle the national stage right now and if she has the talent for that. Very, very few candidates do. Biden does. We do know that already.
And to your first point, Alex, I mean, I think we should just come out and say it. The Democratic Party might just need somebody, maybe an elder statesman, to come out and talk the left down a little bit and say, look, we hear you. We are sympathetic to what you want, and we are working towards these things. However, this is still a coalition party, and in order to win back the White House, we are going to need to bring together the center and the left of the Democratic coalition. That is how Obama won. That is how Clinton won. This idea that the Democratic Party can just race to the left and win back the White House, I think, is fantasy. And I think that Joe Biden might, again, be sort of uniquely positioned to say to some of the liberal most elements of the Democratic Party, again, we hear you and we're sympathetic to some of what you want here, but you are not going to get all of what you want. This is not how government works. This is not how politics works. This is not how elections are won.
Kristen, just to answer really quickly your original question, like, how does Biden appeal to the diversifying base of the Democratic Party? He was Obama's vice president. He would run as continuing the Obama administration, continuing the Obama legacy.
And friends with a black guy?
Look,
that's how he's going
to
win.
I actually think that would be a. You know, doesn't have to say it. No, I actually think he wouldn't have to say it. But the fact that he accomplished what Obama accomplished is going to be a big message for a lot of Democratic rank and file.
He would be haunted by the specter of his work on incarceration bills and his time in the Senate. I mean, there's so much history.
There's a lot.
It's Bill Clinton redux in that sense.
He's literally already apologized about
it's
the NAACP.
You know, guys, this party owes it to black and Hispanic voters to go out searching for candidates who come from the black and Hispanic experience.
If I can just say, as a segue to someone else on my list who I know is kind of immediately prompts eye rolls all across Washington, it's why I think Cory Booker cannot be dismissed as a candidate.
As both Josh and Kristen roll their eyes.
Well, just to note for the record, I almost feel like there's a term in fantasy football, you know, when a player is post-hype. They get all this hype and people think they're going to be great and they have a disappointing season and everyone just ignores them. And I feel like that's the place we're in with Cory Booker, where he's long been considered this potential presidential candidate, but everyone's kind of tired of the shtick. At least in Washington. In Washington, people are tired of the shtick.
Booker, I think, is a second-tier candidate. I think he's a lot more hype than substance. But to your point, Kristen, my reaction is the same as yours, like Joe Biden running as sort of the base candidate. I think some people will see it in that way. But it also speaks to the lack of a bench that the Democratic Party has African-American and Hispanic people in elective office, namely in these Senate and gubernatorial seats. We're talking about Cory Booker because there aren't statewide African-American and statewide Hispanic office holders that can really win a national election or have the ideological record
because
to do
Kasim
so.
Because Kasim Reed isn't ready, right? I mean, when we're talking about black and Hispanic politicians, we're talking about them at a very local level.
Or it's why we're talking about Eric Garcetti as Hispanic, right?
I mean, exactly.
That's what we were doing.
Exactly.
You know, he's half
Jewish,
half Hispanic.
If Villaraigosa wasn't running for governor in California, I think he should be on this list.
There is also another name just to float out there. I was having a lunch with a top Hispanic Democratic activist last week, and he brought up Xavier Becerra, who left Congress and went back to California as AG. Becerra is a guy who has sterling credentials on the left, a guy who is telegenic, well-spoken, can raise money, just somebody I think that we should also put in the sleeper category. But just a final point, again, to return to what we were talking about earlier as maybe focusing too much on the political class. Do you remember about 6 weeks before the Iowa caucuses in 2016 on the Republican side, how clumped together at the top you had Ben Carson, Carly Fiorina, and Donald Trump,
mm-hmm.
right? Three names that we would not have been talking about 18 months before the 2016 primary got underway. So I do think that there was an appetite on the right, not just for the generic outsider, stick it to Washington, but for somebody who would present fresh ideas and fresh rhetoric and kind of fresh presentation to the base of the Republican Party because they felt like it was just the same old, same old. I think that what we saw with the energy behind Bernie Sanders' candidacy was sort of a forerunner of that for 2020. I think that the fact that Bernie was able to mobilize and excite the left the way that to the degree that he did in 2016, I think really opens a huge door for somebody or somebodies to do the same in the Democratic Party. People from the business community, I think, are going to have a real opportunity to break through and become top-tier candidates in 2020.
All right, let's get to our next and favorite segment, Alex. Lightning round. Each one of our panelists will identify a candidate in 2018 that our listeners should keep their ears open for. And the first person to go will be you.
I'm going to pick Claire McCaskill, the senator from Missouri. She is in a very difficult reelection, but the way that the environment is right now, I look at her if, you know, she is able to win next year, which I think is a possibility. It's a great year for Democrats. If she loses, I think it's clear that as good as the environment was, that the map was still too difficult for Democrats in some places. So I look at her as a real bellwether for how the parties did in 2018.
Josh.
I'm going to go with another red state Democratic senator up in 2018, Heidi Heitkamp. She's from North Dakota. What makes that Senate race fascinating is Republicans can't really find anyone to run against a well-liked Democrat in one of the most pro-Trump states in the country. North Dakota is the second most favorable state to Trump in the entire U.S. of A. It's a real dilemma for Republicans, and it speaks to their challenge not only in swing states, not only in the suburbs, but if you can't find a Republican willing to run in North Dakota, if Trump can't get behind such a candidate and can't get them to win office, it shows you how deep and how wide the Republican Party's problems are going to be.
Tim.
Well, great minds think alike, because I'm going to complete the trifecta of red state Dems. I'm going to go to Indiana. Joe Donnelly is a guy who really had no business winning his Senate seat in the first place in 2012. He's got now a trio of pretty competent, I think competitive, Republican challengers who are competing for the GOP nomination to take on Donnelly in the fall of 2018. But look, if Republicans can't win back Indiana, I would say even more so than Missouri or North Dakota. India, we're talking the heart of America, the Rust Belt, Trump country. If Republicans can't win back that Senate seat in Indiana, I think it bodes very, very, very well for Democrats on election night. And I think you're looking at potentially Democrats flipping both chambers.
I'm going with a Republican, Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin. Young guy from a state where Republicans really, really like Trump. He's a veteran. It's a market that Democrats are trying to corner, the veteran candidate. And he's impressing a lot of D.C. power brokers. I think he is worth paying attention to. So that is it for us. Thank you so much, Josh. I hope you will come back for a third time.
I will. When we do our next power rankings, we can have this same spirited debate. And it was great. Great to be back here.
Awesome. And Tim, you always have an invitation.
Yes. That's awesome. Thank you.
Alex, thanks again.
It was lovely to be here.
Thank you to our producer, Jordan Marie Smith, and thank you to our listeners. We want to hear from you, so please send your questions and your comments to btb@mcclatchy.com and connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/beyondthebubblepod. Tell us what you're seeing in your battleground state, and we might even ask you to call into the show. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you use. Leave us a review and tell us what you think. Talk to you next week. Kristen Roberts is sitting here next to her favorite people. It's the National Journal reunion show.
We should bill it as that.
You know, one of you told Shane.
I'm looking at this guy.
Because I got an email from Shane at 11 p.m. last night.
He actually emailed
you? He actually
did.
Oh, sorry, I can lean forward.
If you want to, like, relax and do that.
Yeah.
That's what you're going to do. It's like, yes, I'm going to Sam
Alberta's house tonight. Wait, that'll run the board, too?
No, Jordan, don't sit in Jordan Marie's board.
Unique New York.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Tested.
But you
six, seven.
Really talk like that.
Yeah.
Use your regular voice.
I'll talk about it.
There we go.
He's
raised the light.